we're just sort of going, I wonder what we can create. And one of the main drives behind it was not merely to find some, because I, you know, my fear of boredom is great. I realized this a while ago. I very rarely experience boredom. And when I do, it's horrendous.
So then you're like in this confined space with very limited resources. And then you've got to think about, okay, what do I still have here and what can I talk about and learn about? And so, yeah, that's how it all started.
Are we witnessing the start of an important shift? Has the virus cultivated a set of circumstances for the evolution of how we access, shape and share culture? We're artists and filmmakers, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, and this is the fourth episode of our Somerset House podcast, Coping Mechanisms.
Like many people, when COVID-19 hit, almost all of our projects came to a halt. And in these strange days, it has been heartwarming to see people instigating online activities in order to help, inform, or entertain others. These encounters have helped many of us feel even just a little bit less isolated.
But what can we learn from the people behind these ventures? What drives them to take that extra step? What did they gain from channeling their creative energy into establishing a way to help people? A conversation? A shared experience, a story, a hangout, a drop-in.
In this episode, we talked to Robin Ince about the Stay at Home Festival, Nabeer Iqbal about the Lockdown Herbalist, and we also welcome back Jarvis Cocker to send us off to sleep with his bedtime stories.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince, and you're listening to Coping Mechanisms with Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard.
Robin Ince is many things, comedian, author and broadcaster. Over a decade ago, he created Nine Lessons and Carols for Curious People. These endearingly shambolic series of events mix comedy with music and science. And it's perhaps as a popularizer of scientific ideas that Robin is best known, co-hosting The Infinite Monkey Cage on BBC Radio 4 with Professor Brian Cox. With venues closing and gigs cancelled, Robin launched the Stay at Home Festival online.
The reason we are doing this is because we are constantly fascinated by people and friends who make stuff happen. And I mean, you have more socially distanced fingers in more pies than I think anyone else we know. But we were really impressed with the Stay at Home Festival and wanted to know, what was the initial spark? Like, how did it come about, and so quickly as well in lockdown?
Well, a lot of that's down to my mate Trent as well, because I make a lot of things with him. He's the one. I'm one of those people who, I don't know which one, whether you do have that division between the two of you. You know, there's one person who goes, I've come up with a brilliant idea. We can do this, we can do this, we can do this, and this. And you can probably organise it because I've come up with another idea now. You know, that kind of, and Trent is the person where I can just go, here are all these things. And he'll go, okay, I'll find out what technology is needed to create this. Between the two of us, very early on, the moment that we knew that live gigs were out and we weren't going to be able to do anything, we just started going, I wonder what we can create. And one of the main drives behind it was not merely to find some, because I, you know, my fear of boredom is great. I realised this a while ago. I very rarely experience boredom. And when I do, it's horrendous. When you are placed in a boring situation, which there is no way out of whatsoever, you know, I've unfortunately got an occupation where I can go, I can create something else, I can do something else. I don't have to go to that dinner party because I'm a social embarrassment, so I've got my kind of, I'm allowed a free, you know, card out of that. So I was also thinking, I don't want to get bored. But the other thing was, I know that a lot of the kind of audiences that come to the shows that I put on and that I do with Josie, and the solo shows that I do and Josie does, and generally that they are sometimes a connection for people who might feel slightly on the outside and slightly like, kind of, you know, they don't feel part of the very mainstream thinking. And of course, the mass media, despite the enormous number of channels, is dominated, I think, by a very kind of mainstream thinking. And so we thought, well, it would be nice if people woke up in the morning and the first conversation, while they're feeling this sense of isolation, and they might have loads of things they've got to deal with their children, or perhaps those who are living with their parents or looking after them, carers and all of that kind of thing, it might be nice if they can have a conversation that we'll basically do for them. And also, I thought very early on, with it's so direct looking into the camera of a laptop. it is, you know, last night I did a thing which was about an hour and a half. I didn't do anything I intended. The week before I'd done a thing based on my book, I'm a Joke and So Are You, but I only got halfway through. I didn't really get halfway through. So people said, will you do it next week? And then last night I accidentally didn't do any of what I was meant to do. And it feels kind of weird just to be talking directly to a laptop. But you do afterwards get a sense that people did feel... And I know that psychologically as well, I've been talking to neuroscientists and psychologists, that people who are getting worried if they've got a small child, how is it going to affect a child that's very little and its neural pruning is going on so fast when they're not having these social meetings? And someone said, actually, the effect of a communication on a laptop camera with, you know, all of that stuff on Skype or Zoom or whatever, that will still be good for that child. So it's all of those things. There were lots of different things. The avoidance of boredom, the fact that everyone was trapped in their houses, and I went, oh, brilliant, that means no one's got an alibi. In fact, only about two people said no, because everyone was like, you know, Mark Gatiss, I think, was the first person who said yes. He was like, oh, God, yes, oh, I'm so bored. You know, so he was straight in there. And it was, yeah, it was all of those different things. And I just thought, and for Josie as well, it was a lot of, you know, it meant that every morning I got to work with Josie and Trent, and we had a nice meeting, and Josie's got a young child. So, you know, you want, and especially she was about to go on tour for the first time she's had a child. So she had the first, right, I have this moment of freedom, and then it was suddenly curtailed. So, yeah, it was so, sorry, that's a very long answer, but it was lots of different things. And it was also just like, I think we can do it, so let's just see if it works. Let's just make it.
Does it help you to feel like you're being useful?
Yeah, I mean, that's my whole existence, I've realised, is, you know, desperate hope that I've done something that's useful. It's, you know, as pathetic as that might sound, it is, you know, more and more with the gigs that I've done, I find it more and more important. And whereas on the lockdown thing, this was a much simpler thing, which was going, I think we can make something tangible that will be useful to people.
What surprised you about of all the kind of activities you've been doing through for other people, you know, for an audience, what surprised you? What feedback have you had that's been surprising or moving?
It's interesting because I think it's the very obvious thing, which is I don't think I'd realised how many people felt so lost by this. I think because I did just descend into busyness. And I've had a very, very small kind of diameter of, you know, going out and seeing anything. And I didn't, when you find out how lost people have been and how much they, you know, it's only a small group of people, you know, we're not a huge thing or anything like that, but the use that they found from it, the first time you get feedback, which, you know, I couldn't sleep last night, and I just don't know when my job's going to start again. And then there were just you and Josie and, you know, whoever else, just talking nonsense. And Joe Brand said something that was so useful to me. And what's the surprise is always that, like a real-life conversation, because no one knows what they're going to say when the conversation starts, very often at the end of it, you don't realise that one of our guests or someone who's done something has suddenly said something incredibly useful. And they didn't, again, it's back to that thing, they didn't know they'd intended, but you know, always if you have Jo Brand on anything, really, you know, she is a very, you know, humane person. And the feedback you get when, oh, I'd not... do you know what? It's very like stand-up in that way, which is when you're at your maximum kind of freak on stage, just when you think you might have pushed it too far in terms of revealing some form of possible insanity in your head, you then find out when you go to the bar afterwards that lots of people go, I didn't know, I've got that in my head. I've got that in my head as well. And that. So I think it's been that, most of all, that has been just an interesting thing to see. So I don't, in one way, I don't feel that there's been any great revelation from it, if that makes sense, but within that, it's just been really nice to know that so many different people that we've spoken, and I found it really interesting as well, so some of the guests we've had on who aren't able to create anything, quite a few of the artists we've had on have been absolutely stuck for months now, that they have found it so overbearing, this, you know, watching not merely in a pandemic but watching the incredible vanity and incompetence of this government dealing with it, that they feel very lost. You know, it's like that moment, you know, that moment when Trump won the election and you kind of just went, but, and I don't know how you, on that day, I remember waking up in Bristol, I was on tour with Brian Cox and I felt utterly, utterly, utterly lost. And I remember just walking through the streets and everyone was just going, and I went into a bookshop and we had this conversation with this guy. It's like that feeling, but it's been stretched out for some people. Not for me, I've been lucky, but for other people it's been like for months on end, which is the one thing that they do in their life the whole time, which is to create things, has stopped.
Yeah, we've definitely found that there's the added pressure you put on yourself as well, that you know, for the first few foolish days, you kind of think, time, we've got time, brilliant, time. We were always saying we needed more time. Excellent, right. We've got all the time in the world now. We can get on with this. Brilliant. We're just going to be, you know. Yeah, turns out we didn't need time. We needed motivation.
Yeah.
But we still don't have that.
Or skills we simply don't have.
And it really, I think, from the off, that's what surprised us, that you mobilised so quickly to support the kind of independent sector of culture.
Well, you found it's been an interesting time, isn't it, psychologically, to actually find out how many people consider art to be a nothing and a pointlessness. I think a lot of people think that anyone who creates art, it's a luxury, that they're very lucky, and it's not a real job, and all of that stuff. And it doesn't matter how hard people work, and the fact that, as we both know, in the musical world, in the comedy world, in poetry, in novels and all that kind of thing, an enormous number of people who do those jobs, they're not even their full-time jobs. They're kind of, it's a real struggle all the time, and they very often have to take other jobs as well to try and keep it balanced. And yet there is this idea, in the same way that the liberal media elite and all those other kind of things that are bandied around, that anyone who creates anything is basically just a fortunate golden-crusted fop. But we live, you know, we've been living 10 years where libraries are something that's not required, education is not required, joy is not required. Sorry, that sounded very kind of, but I don't mean that in a doom-laden way, because I also think at the same time this will be another thing that spurs people to go, these things are good and these things are interesting, and it doesn't matter if not everything sells 15,000 tickets and fills the O2.
You can do stuff, you know, that it is okay, it is allowed, and actually most of the time it just takes bothering to do it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of where we started with the idea for these podcasts, was just trying to understand something about, you know, that line between those of us who, and I think, you know, it's within both, or within all of us, you know, the ability to sit around in a pub table and talk about what you should be doing and what you could be doing, and then go home and do literally none of it, versus those people who just cross that very tiny line into, actually, I will organise that thing, I will put that gig on, or I will start that fanzine, or I will write that poem. Or it really is just about putting the work in. You know, creativity is not this kind of, you know, magical bolt from the sky that, and sure, there's an element of magic, and, you know, we all kind of have those moments of inspiration, but the inspiration kind of counts for nothing if you just sit in the pub and talk about what a great album you would have made if you'd have bothered.
But more often, it's not even that, is it? What you're doing is saying, I'll tell you who's done something rubbish, I'll tell you something else that's rubbish. And I do get, sometimes if people are being particularly kind of aggressive on social media about something that's been created that I've been involved with, I say, if you're really angry about this, then you need to make something. If you feel that the things you want do not exist, you can play a part in that. And people will help you if you want to make those things. Because I was thinking, you know, there's certain towns. I remember when I used to, you know, when I was on the kind of the comedy club circuit, and I'd meet some comic somewhere in Manchester. He'd say, oh, there's a small town that never has anything on. It's like about 30 miles out of Manchester. Would you come and do it on a Sunday night? I'd go, yeah. And then what you find is there are a lot of places that thrive on complaining that nothing ever happens there. And they hate the idea of anything happening there, because that would mean they might have to go out. and they don't really want to. What they want to say is nothing's been done. And that's not, you know, I know that it doesn't, but that's the bit that frustrates me. And I try to, I've realised with my cynicism, the battle against that, which is, if you don't, like when I write a radio column for The Big Issue, and I never write about radio that I don't like, because that seems an utter waste of time. You know, I especially when there's so much out there that is good and interesting, I just need to work harder to, I have sometimes listened to a radio show and gone, oh, I can't say I like that. That was, so I just won't write about it. I'm going to find another thing. And I think that is, and once you mix with more people like that, it then becomes too ridiculous. If people say, well, I could have done that, do it. You know what? I know you went to the Tate Modern and you were so angry about Tracy Emin. Well, do it, because you said that you could do it. Do it. Do it. Come on, you can do it.
Are we talking about like a restructuring or a rearranging of the hierarchies of how we access art, of how we kind of participate, and that performer and participant are often accessing using the same platform and are able to kind of, in a way, have the same voice, you know? What do you hope will happen in the future? Do you want things to go back to normal?
No, not really. I hope, I mean, there's been interesting things that I've watched. There's things like someone I know, a friend of mine, he lives down the street from me, and he works for Age UK. And he, during this time, there's been loads of people in my town who he's managed to get to go and do various different things to help Age UK. And there's loads of people who've gone, oh, it's not really my thing, or I don't really know how to talk to old people, or whatever it might be. And someone was saying, oh, it's all going to go back to the way it was before. But I think there's going to have been enough people that have had a dopamine hit from doing things that were kind of out of their comfort zone, but they thought they should do because they are good people with good intentions, but they just didn't quite know how to, or always had work on or whatever. Because that's the problem, isn't it? We've got such a huge amount of entertainment available that you may well go to what you know you like. You know, everything's got an algorithm. So, whatever you're using on the internet, it will then say, you're like this too. So before you have the chance to maybe adventure in another direction, you like these kind of films. Here's more of these kind of films. And I think it's so important every now and again, or as often as possible, to go, I've got no idea if this is my thing at all. There's films you would never watch if they were on your stack of DVDs or whatever. You never get round to it. You keep meaning to. It's a film you like. But the moment it's on television, the moment it's on now, it's happening now, there's a totally different emotional reaction to it. And so I think that as well, the stuff that, you know, Karen Wall is doing, the stuff that Tim Burgess is doing, that bit of this is now, it's happening now. And I think there is something, which is, I don't know how quantifiable it is, which is the connectivity of, you know, that it's a bit like every now and again, this probably sounds pretentious or stupid, but because I've been looking at the same square of sky every single day and watching how it changes. And I sometimes think about the possibility, first of all, who else is looking at it at the same time? If you could draw an arrow around, you know, say a particular corner of Europe and wondered how many people are looking at Venus all at the same time. And then sometimes when I'm looking at a star, I think, I wonder if there's another arrow from another planet where there's another curious creature that happens to be looking. And if you drew that, there would be a triangle of kind of observation. And that gives me kind of a sense of happiness and might be entirely non-existent fictional connection. And I think there is another thing as well, which is that connection of, in a way of, we're all listening to this album. Every single one of us has returned to this album. It was, you know, so many of those albums he's chosen. It's interesting when you find different people who've been shaped by it. And it's allowed people to focus on those things.
I think there is meaning in doing things at the same time, even if you're not in the same place, even if you can't see or don't absolutely know. Just the idea that other people are doing the same thing as you at the same time feels good. It feels meaningful. It feels purposeful in a way.
I don't know what that kind of strange, you know, synchronicity is probably the wrong word for it, whatever it is, because it's not something that's a kind of palpable thing, is it? But it is. That's what I love. The book that I've been working on is so many different things which are transcendent moments, which words cannot be. There's no point in trying to work out the equation or the sentence describing it, because you just have to accept it as a transcendent moment and then nudge someone and go, you look too. That's all you can do. Or you listen too. Or, and it probably won't replicate the same thing for you, but it doesn't matter. But it's those things that cannot be put in words and don't need to be put in words and don't need to be described, really.
Nabeer Iqbal is a musician, producer and radio presenter. She's also a fellow resident at Somerset House Studios. Since 2013, she's hosted a show on NTS Radio exploring the musical traditions of different countries. Nabeer was with her mother visiting family in Pakistan when the travel ban was imposed. Unable to get home, she launched the Lockdown Herbalist on Instagram, where she shares knowledge learnt from her grandparents. So we'd love you to talk about the situation you found yourself in lockdown and why you began to broadcast, really, why you began to kind of reach out.
My lockdown story is a bit more unusual, I guess, because, this year's been crazy for everybody, but I feel like on top of all the general things that, you know, the public are facing, I've had a lot of personal obstacles come up over the last few months. So I ended up travelling out to Pakistan in an emergency at the beginning of March, right after my music studio got burgled. So it was like one massive thing after another. And the reason why I went out to Pakistan is because I heard that my granddad had fallen really ill. He'd had a brain hemorrhage and he's my most favourite person in the world. So just literally, it was like the day after the burglary, and then I just booked a flight to travel out the day after. When I left London, everything was still normal here. It wasn't lockdown, but in other parts of the world, the coronavirus emergency was, you know, gathering quite a lot of momentum, and I would never choose to travel at that time, and it felt weird because Heathrow was completely empty. But then what was supposed to just be a 2-week trip out to Pakistan ended up being a 2-month stay, because the day that myself and my mum were supposed to fly back to London was the day that the Pakistani government announced their lockdown, and their lockdown was a lot stricter than the one over here. So they immediately shut all international and domestic flights, all trains. They roadblocked all of the motorways, shops were closed, schools were closed. And also they'd blockaded each neighborhood as well. So you couldn't even get out of your area. So it was really severe. And then we just also had no idea when it was gonna end, because every time when they announced a date that it was going to end, it got to that date and then it was extended, and that just kept happening. So it was a very strange situation to be in. I mean, I travel so much and I've never been in a situation where I have no idea about when I'll be able to go back home. So that was a new experience for me. And then it was like a lot of emotions going on. Obviously, I hadn't even processed the fact that I just lost 2 years' worth of my work and my whole entire new album. And then just having to look after my grandfather to make sure, that was like quite an emotional ordeal for me. And then being stuck over there, which was nice because actually I got to spend more time with my grandparents, because I hadn't planned to be away for so long. I hadn't taken things with me so that I'd be able to work from out there. Also, just being like separated from all of your friends for so long. I think the way I was kind of like processing this day and thinking about what can I do, I don't know what triggered it. I started doing these lockdown herbalist videos where I think just it started with me posting one Instagram story about a herbal remedy that my grandparents use a lot. And just that like 15 second clip got so much positive feedback. And then I thought, okay, would people like to see more of this kind of thing? To me, it just, I had no idea about it, because most of my followers follow me because of my music and my radio shows and things like that. And herbalist stuff is just completely on the other end of the spectrum from that. But people really responded to it. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm in a different place. And this is like a new, I'm learning all these new things, which I would never have the chance to learn about if I wasn't there. Because it's not the same as being in London and just going to a health food store and just buying whatever supplement is trending. Because out in Pakistan, all of these plant remedies, they're really a way of life. And a lot of the time I was just going out to my grandparents' garden and picking things that were growing there to talk about. So, you know, it's very organic, like no pun intended, but it just felt that way. And so yeah, and I posted one video and then that got a really good response, and then I kept doing it, and people really liked the fact that I was sharing knowledge that was new to them as well. So, you know, everyone's learning, and I think that just stems from me being a bit of a geek and always being quite enthusiastic about learning new knowledge, but then also wanting to share it. I also like the idea that, you know, you can use Instagram for these kind of purposes, and sometimes you can feel a bit disheartened, especially as a female, when you go on Instagram and you see the pictures that get the most likes are the ones of like girls in bikinis and stuff, you know, like quite posery things. And I'm not about that at all. So I think my following is probably as geeky as I am.
I think also everyone's just been so hungry for positive material online, you know. I think, you know, lockdown obviously was the sort of start of a wave of kind of difficult times for people, but I just think anything that has something that feels sincere and feels hopeful.
Did your grandparents watch?
Yeah, they did. They watched the videos back and they liked them, and they were just kind of like giving me more input on the research side. You know, they really helped me with the whole learning process. But, you know, picking stuff out from the garden or picking stuff out from the kitchen and talking to me about it and telling me why it's good. And my grandma, she's really into YouTube now, so she was just searching up all the videos of all the different herbs and spices and plants that I was talking about. So yeah, it was definitely a family effort. I wouldn't have been able to do it without my mum or my grandparents. This idea of usefulness, I think, is quite an important perspective to have when you're thinking about what you're posting on social media, especially if you have a platform. And yeah, what's the purpose of it in the public domain? And that's something that's quite important to me. So, I mean, you know, whenever I travel to a new place, I'm always posting information about it on my social media, making funny little travel documentaries. For example, I did that when I was in Turkey or at the pyramids in Egypt. But then, you know, it was a very strange sensation to be stuck in a foreign land for so long, yet not being able to go out anywhere. Over the course of a month, I probably only went out the house like 3 times or 4 times just to get groceries, because one, there was nothing, there's nowhere to go. And two, you know, we were self-isolating with my grandparents and they're really high risk. So we had to just be super careful about all of that stuff. So then you're like in this confined space with very limited resources. And then you've got to think about, okay, what do I still have here and what can I talk about and learn about?
What was the most surprising feedback you had?
What I really enjoyed is that it became a discussion point. So everything that I shared a video about, you had people commenting underneath about their own tips that they'd learned about those same spices or herbs or whatever. And that was cool, because then it's like, oh, you're comparing notes. Other people are also sharing the knowledge. So it becomes like a, you know, something slightly bigger. But I think out of all of the things that I made videos for in the Lockdown Herbalist series, the most interesting one to me was something called Silajit, which I had never heard of before, but it's this like black sticky resin that seeps out of the Himalayan mountains, and it's basically fossilized plant matter that's like thousands of years old. You can only get it at a certain time of year when the weather's warm and it comes out of the rocks, and also you only find it between altitudes of around 3,000 to 6,000 meters. People have to climb up really high, but you know, you have to do like a serious mountain trek before you even get to where you can access that. And then it's just very concentrated mineral content. You only take a tiny little bit, and then it just helps you with just general energy and nutrition and things like that. Because then it makes you think about the whole culture of humans in a way, like how did people find out that stuff and how did they start taking it and why, and people's commitment to climbing mountains to just get this, you know, tiny amount of black. It looks like like oily, sticky stuff coming out of the rock. In a country like England, where you have to import most fruit and veg and other things, you know, nothing tastes as fresh. So I really do miss being in Pakistan and eating my grandma's cooking and just eating fruit and vegetables that taste so amazing. Like, nothing here compares to that at all. So I miss that a lot. But there's a lot of those dried herbs and spices which are readily available here. I started incorporating a few of them into my daily routine because, I'm all for trying natural remedies rather than synthetic ones. So even though most medicine, like pharmaceutical medicine, is all plant derived, people don't always realize that. Why not go back to the roots? So I've been taking cumin, which in Urdu is called zira, but there's two types, and I've been taking the white one every morning. It's good for digestion on an empty stomach. You just pick like a few of the seeds and swallow it down with water. And then also this other thing called kalvanji, which in English is called black seed. Like a very descriptive name, and again that's supposed to have like really good health benefits, kind of like a cure-all, a panacea. It's supposed to be anti-inflammatory, good for digestion, good for your immune system. So I've been taking that as well every morning, and I just picked up both of those things in a local Arabic supermarket. And that's the amazing thing about London, is that, you know, everything's available if you look for it.
Do you think if you hadn't have had the devastating incident of losing all of the music you've been working on for the last couple of years, do you think your output would have been different if you had had that laptop with you?
Just not having any of my usual things around me which keep me busy, it just makes you think about totally different things. And actually it was nice to just spend quality time with my grandparents and just learning more about our culture of plant medicine. And I found out my great-grandfather was a herbalist as well, so maybe I'm channeling a bit of him. So yeah, and also it was just forced rest. I think my body was just exhausted from so much touring and traveling, and I wasn't feeling very well at the beginning of this year. And then I went out to Pakistan, and it was just total detox, so I wasn't eating any processed food, no sugar. The sweetest thing I was eating was fruit, and just healthy, fresh food that my grandma was cooking every day. And in a way, it was kind of a blessing in disguise, because I feel much better now.
Do you feel that this kind of radical changes happening in culture around you? Are you seeing things that feel promising?
I feel, especially with the music industry, you know, the whole thing's been shaken up, because a lot of it relies on being able to travel or being able to be in a room with hundreds or thousands of people all standing right next to each other. And so, you know, I think no one really knows exactly where we stand at the moment. People are trying to figure things out. I'm seeing a lot of things about streaming online, whether it's DJ sets or live shows, and it's nice to see people trying to make an effort to try and figure out how they can get around all of these new rules and regulations. But at the same time, my personal opinion is that no matter how much you try and absorb live music in inverted commas through a screen, it's just not the same, because I think music's the most spiritual art form, and to experience it fully you need to be feeling it in your body and you need to be close to it. And whether that means being in a club dancing to techno or being at a live performance of an artist that you love in a venue or at a festival, we need those things, because it's all about the collective experience, and you just can't get it through a flat screen. So I really hope that somehow the current pandemic will come under control, and I'm sure it will, because, you know, every single pandemic beforehand has been able to be controlled. Obviously nothing's happened on the scale as we're witnessing now, but I still have faith in the fact that things will return to normal. But maybe that's me being idealistic as a musician, but I can't imagine it any other way. Like, I didn't realize how much I need live music and the nightclub experience until it got taken away from all of us, you know. And now I just can't wait to DJ or to just dance with my friends or what, yeah, just any of that stuff. I hope we can have it back.
I'm going to read you a story this evening called The Spring Tune by Tove Jansson. First thing I thought of was, like a lot of people, I think at the start of the lockdown, I had a bit of trouble sleeping. You know, I was having a bit of insomnia. You know, I used to do kind of stories. When I was doing a radio show for Six Music for the BBC, I would occasionally read stories on that. So I knew I had a kind of stockpile of stories there. The Enormous Crocodile by Roald Dahl. In In the biggest, brownest, muddiest river in Africa, two crocodiles lay with their heads just above the water. One of the crocodiles was enormous. The other was not so big. "Do you know what I would like for my lunch today?" the enormous crocodile asked. "No," the not-so-big one said.
"What?"
So I decided to post every Sunday night at 9:30 p.m. post a bedtime story. So I've been doing that, Jarvis Cocker's bedtime stories. People have told me that my voice helps them to fall asleep. I try not to be offended by that, you know, that I'm boring them to sleep. I've taken that as a compliment. A lot of the work that I've done over the last few years has all been about trying to lull people into some kind of semi-conscious state through using this kind of voice where we keep it at the same level and we just kind of, it's almost like hypnotism or something, we just kind of drone, and you know, gradually you will drift off into semi-consciousness or complete unconsciousness, I don't know.
One calm and cloudless evening, towards the end of March, Snufkin found himself far enough to the north to see still unmelted patches of snow on the northern slopes. He'd been walking all day through undisturbed landscapes, listening to the cries of the birds, also on their way northwards, home from the south. Walking had been easy because his knapsack was nearly empty and he had no worries on his mind.
I like to read stories. There's something different to having a story read out aloud than to just reading it and kind of reading it in your own voice inside your head, you know. I mean, I love to listen to stories, and I mean, if I can't sleep, what I generally do is I'll put the World Service on or something like that. I think there's something about hearing another human voice at that time, because it's usually, you know, the worst time to have insomnia is like 3 or 4 in the morning, where, you know, it's too early to get up and do anything and you're kind of left alone with your thoughts. It can be a very vulnerable time. And so to just hear another human voice at that time, I think just on a really basic level, just makes you feel like you're not alone in some ways. You can use creativity to escape your surroundings. Anyway, that's enough from me. Hope you enjoy it.
He felt happy about the wood and the weather and himself. Tomorrow and yesterday were both at a distance, and just at present the sun was shining brightly red between the birches and the air was cool and soft. It's the right evening for a tune, Snufkin thought. A new tune. One part expectation, two parts spring sadness, and for the rest, just the great delight of walking alone and liking it.
Coping Mechanisms is a Somerset House podcast, created by Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, produced by Eleanor Scott and Daniel Brewer. Music by Bernholtz. Thank you to all the artists who have contributed to the series.
To listen to more and to subscribe to the Somerset House podcast, search Somerset House on your favourite podcast app.
Over and out.